So far, there had been nothing on any front. Whatever had been solved about the case, I had solved myself. Jesse Flanagan was dressed in loose black trousers, with a simple white blouse and scuffed tennis sneakers. "Something's happened," I said.
"No, Alex. We haven't heard any more about Maggie Rose," she said.
"A few more sightings, that's all."
Sightings were what the Federal Bureau called eyewitness accounts from people claiming to have seen Maggie Rose or Gary Sinise. So far, the sightings ranged from an empty lot a few streets from Washington Day School to California.
"I didn't mean to intrude on you guys," she said and smiled. "It's just that I've been feeling bad about what's happened, Alex. The stories about you are crap. I wanted to tell you how I felt, so here I am."
"Well, thanks for saying it," I said to Jesse. It was one of the only nice things that had happened to me in the past week.
"You did everything you could in Florida. I'm not just saying that to make you feel better."
"I wouldn't call it one of my better work experiences. On the other hand, I didn't think I deserved front-page coverage for my performance."
"You didn't. Somebody nailed you. Somebody set you up with the press. It's a lot of bull."
"It's bullshit," Damon blurted. "Right, Big Daddy?"
"This is Jesse," I said to the kids. "We work together sometimes." The kids were getting used to Jesse, but they were still a little shy. Jenny was trying to hide behind her brother. Damon had both hands stuffed in his back pockets, just like his dad. Jesse went down on her haunches. She got down to their size. She shook hands with Damon, then with Janelle.
"Your daddy is the best policeman I ever saw," she told Damon.
"I know that,"
he accepted the compliment graciously.
"I'm Janelle."
Janelle surprised me by offering her name to Jesse. I could tell she wanted a hug. Janelle loves hugs more than anyone ever put on this earth. That's where she got one of her many nicknames, Velcro. Jesse sensed it, too. She reached out and hugged Jenny. Damon immediately decided to join in. After a minute or so, Jesse stood up again. At that moment, it struck me that she was a real nice person, and that I hadn't met too many of those during the investigation.
"Well, I just stopped by for a few hugs."
She winked to me.
"Actually, I have a case not too far from here. Now I'm off to be a workaholic again."
"How about some hot coffee?" I asked her. She squinted a look at me, and she started to smile again.
"Two nice kids, nice Sunday morning at home with them. You're not such a tough guy after all."
"No, I'm a tough guy too," I said. "I just happen to be a tough guy who finds his way home by Sunday morning."
"I've got to go. I'll take a rain check on the coffee."
Jesse Flanagan opened the front door and started to leave. She waved to the kids as the door was closing behind her.
"So long, Big Daddy,"
she said to me and grinned.
On the night of January 11th, Gary Murphy was cozy and safe in his basement. Nobody knew that he was down there, but if Snoopy Missy happened to open the basement door, he'd just flick on the lamp at his workbench. He was thinking everything through. Around midnight, he realized that his little family had gone to bed without him. No one had even bothered to call down to him. They didn't care. He finally left the cellar, and then the house in Wilmington. It was just past 5:30 in the morning. He drove back to D.C. There was more work to do there. Around 11 that morning, Tuesday, Gary Murphy lightly tapped the front doorbell of a well-kept brick townhouse on the edge of Capitol Hill. Bing-bong went a polite door chime inside. Vivian Kim kept the lock chain on, but she opened the door about a foot. She'd seen the familiar uniform of Washington's Pepco Public Utilities Service through the peephole. Pretty lady, Gary remembered from the Washington Day School. Long black braids, cute little upturned nose. She clearly didn't recognize him as a blonde. No mustache, little flesh off the cheeks and chin. "Can I help you?" she asked the man standing on her porch. "I hope it's the other way around," he smiled pleasantly. "Somebody called about an overcharge on the electric." Vivian Kim frowned and shook her head. "I didn't call anybody. I know I didn't call Pepco." "Well, somebody called us, miss." "Come back some other time," Vivian Kim told him. "Maybe my boyfriend called. You'll have to come back. I'm sorry." Gary shrugged his shoulders. "I guess you can call us again if you like," he said. get on the schedule again. It's an overcharge, though. You paid too much. Okay, I hear you. I understand. Vivian Kim slowly stripped away the chain and opened the door. Gary stepped into the apartment. He pulled a long hunting knife from under his work jacket. He pointed it at the teacher's face. Don't scream. Do not scream, Vivian.
Samson and I raced down C Street in the heart of Capitol Hill. Squad cars from the department and EMS ambulances had the street completely blocked off. We had to park on F Street and sprint the last couple of blocks. WJLA-TV was already there. So was CNN. I spotted a clique of reporters up ahead. They saw Samson and me coming. Detective Cross! Dr. Cross! The reporters called out, trying to slow us down. No comment, I waved them off. Get the fuck out of the way! Inside Vivian Kim's apartment, Samson and I passed all the familiar faces. Techies, forensics, the DOA gang in their ghoulish element.
I don't want to do this anymore, Samson said. We burn out, I mumbled to him. We burn out together.
Samson grabbed my hand and held it. That told me he was as fucked up about this as he got. We went inside the first bedroom on the right side of the hallway. Vivian Kim's bedroom was beautifully laid out. Lots of exquisite black-and-white family photographs and art posters covered most of the wall space. I didn't want to look at the reason I was there. Finally, I had to. Vivian Kim was pinned to the bed with a long hunting knife. It was driven through her stomach. Both her breasts had been removed. Her pubic hair had been shaved. I let my eyes wander around the bedroom. I couldn't look at Vivian Kim's mutilated body. I stared at a splash of bright color on the floor. I caught my breath. Nobody had said anything about it on the way up. Nobody had noticed the most important clue. Fortunately, nobody had moved the evidence. Look at this here, I showed Samson. Maggie Rose Dunn's second sneaker was lying on Vivian Kim's bedroom floor. The killer was leaving what the pathologists call artistic touches. He'd left an overt message this time. The signature of signatures. I was shaking as I bent down over the little girl's sneaker. Gary Sinigi had been in the bedroom. Sinigi was the project killer, too. He was the thing, and he was back in town. Gary Sinigi was still in Washington, indeed. There was a difference now. He was baiting us. Samson and I got a dispensation from the jefe. We could work on the kidnapping as long as it was linked to the other murder investigations. It definitely was.
This is our day off, so we must be having fun, Samson said to me as we walked the streets of Southeast. It was the 13th of January. Bitter cold.
We were canvassing Vivian Kim's neighborhood, which was on the edge of Southeast. Canvassing a neighborhood is mind-numbing work, even for the young and uninitiated. Did you see anyone or anything unusual yesterday? We asked anybody dumb enough to open the doors for us. Did you notice any strangers, strange cars, anything that sticks out in your mind? Let us decide whether it's important. As usual, nobody had seen a thing. We finally trudged back toward our car around 6. We were beaten up. We'd blown a long day. Nothing good had come of it. Gary Sinigi had disappeared into thin air again.
Want to go out a few extra blocks? I asked Samson. For Miss Vivian. Least we can do.
We filed into the apartment of a Mrs. Quilly McBride at around 6:20 that night. Quilly and her friend Mrs. Scott were seated at the kitchen table. Mrs. Scott had something to tell us that she thought might help. We were there to listen to anything she had to say.
I believe I can help y'all,
Mrs. Scott said in a soft, sincere voice. She was probably 80 years old, but very focused and clear in her delivery. We'd appreciate that, I said. The four of us sat around the kitchen table.
I heard about the murder of the teacher, Mrs. Scott said for Samson's and my benefit. And, well, I saw a man driving around the neighborhood a month or so before the Turner murders. He was a white man. I am fortunate to still have a very good memory. 10 years from today, I will be able to recall this interview on a moment-to-moment basis, detectives.
Her friend, Mrs. McBride, had pulled her chair beside Mrs. Scott.
It's true. She will,
Quilly McBride said.
1 week before the Turner murders, the same white man came through the neighborhood again, Mrs. Scott continued. The second time, he was going door to door. He was a salesman.
Samson and I looked at each other.
What kind of salesman? Samson asked her.
He was selling heating systems for the winter. I went over by his car and looked inside. A sales book of some sort was on the front seat. His company is called Atlantic Heating, out of Wilmington, Delaware.
Mrs. Scott looked from face to face, either to make sure she was being clear or that we were getting all of what she had just said.
Yesterday, I saw the same car drive through the neighborhood. I saw the car the morning the woman on C Street was killed. I said to my friend here, this can't be all coincidence, can it? Now, I don't know if he's the one you're looking for, but I think you should talk to him.
Samson looked at me. Then the two of us did a rare thing of late. We broke into smiles. We had something. We had a break. Finally, the first of the case.
We're going to talk to the traveling salesman, I said to Mrs. Scott and Quilly McBride. We're going to Wilmington, Delaware.
Gary Murphy got home at a little past 5 on the following afternoon, January 14th. He'd gone into the office just outside Wilmington. Only a few people had been there, and he'd planned to get some useless paperwork done. He had to make things look good for a little while longer. Gary just couldn't get serious about the paper blizzard of bills and invoices littering his desk. He kept picking up crumpled customer bills, glancing at names, amounts, addresses. Who, in their right fucking mind, could care about all the invoices? He was thinking to himself. So he accomplished absolutely nothing at the office, except blowing off a few hours. At least he'd picked up a present for Ronnie on the way home. He bought Ronnie a pink bike with training wheels and streamers. He added a Barbie dream house. Her birthday party was set for 6 o'clock. Missy met him at the front door with a hug and a kiss. Positive reinforcement was her strong suit. The party gave her something to think about. She had been off his back for days. Great day, honey. I kid you not. 3 home visits set up for next week. Count them. 3, Gary told her. He followed Missy into the dining room where she was setting out brightly colored plastic and paper for the party of parties. This is pure genius, hon. You can make something out of nothing. This all looks fantastic, Gary said. Actually, he was starting to get a little depressed. He felt out of it and wanted to take a nap. The idea of Ronnie's birthday party seemed exhausting suddenly. There sure hadn't been any parties when he was a kid. The neighbors started to arrive right at 6 o'clock. That was good, he thought. It meant the kids really wanted to come. They liked Ronnie. Several of the parents stayed for the party. They were friends of his and Missy's. He dutifully played bartender while Missy started the kids on an assortment of games.
The house was 2-story white-painted brick on a wooded half-lot. It was already surrounded by cars, station wagons, jeeps, the family vehicles of suburbia.
This can't be his house, Samson said as we parked on a side street. The thing doesn't live here. Jimmy Stewart does.
We had found Gary Sinigi, but it didn't feel right. The monstrous house was a perfect suburban beauty, a gingerbread house on a well-maintained street in Wilmington, Delaware. It was a little less than 24 hours since we'd spoken to Mrs. Scott in D.C. In that time, we had tracked down Atlantic Heating in Wilmington. We had gathered the original hostage rescue team together. Lights were shining through most of the house windows. A Domino's delivery truck arrived at almost the same time that we did. A lanky blonde kid ran to the door with 4 big pizza boxes in his outstretched arms. The delivery kid got paid, then the truck was gone as quickly as it had come.
"Let's move," I said to Special Agent Scorse. "This is it, folks."
9 of us rushed the house. Scorse, Craig, and 3 others from the Bureau. Samson, myself, Jeb Kleppner, Jesse Flanagan. We were heavily armed and wore bulletproof vests. We wanted to end this. I entered through the kitchen. Scorse and I came in together. Samson was a step behind.
"Who are you men? What's going on?"
A woman at the kitchen counter screamed as we burst inside.
"Where is Gary Murphy?" I asked in a loud voice.
I flashed my ID at the same time.
"I'm Alex Cross, police. We're here in connection with the Maggie Rose Dunn kidnapping."
"Gary's in the dining room,"
a second woman standing over a blender said in a trembling voice.
"Through here,"
she pointed. We ran down the connecting hallway. We had our revolvers drawn. It was a terrifying moment. The children we saw were afraid, so were their mothers and fathers. Garrison Eiji wasn't anywhere in the dining room. Just more police, kids in birthday hats, mothers and dads with their mouths open in disbelief.
"I think Gary went upstairs," one of the fathers finally said. "What's going on here?"
Agents Craig and Riley were already crashing back down the stairs into the front hallway.
"Not up there,"
Riley yelled. One of the kids said,
"I think Mr. Murphy went down to the cellar. What'd he do?"
We ran back to the kitchen and down to the cellar. No one was anywhere in the two small cellar rooms. There was a storm door to the outside. It was closed and locked from the outside. Garrison Eiji had disappeared again. Samson and I were still at the Murphy house at well past 11 o'clock. The press was gathered behind bright yellow ropes outside. Another massive manhunt had already been set in motion along the eastern seaboard, but also west into Pennsylvania and Ohio. It seemed impossible that Garrison Eiji / Murphy could get away a second time. We didn't believe he could have planned this escape the way he'd planned the one out of Washington. One of the kids at the party had spotted a local police cruiser doing a ride-by minutes before we arrived in the neighborhood. The boy had innocently mentioned the police car to Mr. Murphy. He had escaped through sheer luck. Samson and I questioned Missy Murphy for more than an hour. We were finally going to learn something about the real Sinigi / Murphy. Missy Murphy would have fit in with the mothers of the children at Washington Day School. She wore her blonde hair in a no-frills flip. She had on a navy skirt, white blouse, boaters. She was a few pounds overweight, but pretty.
"None of you seem to believe this, but I know Gary. I know who he is," she told us. "He is not a kidnapper."
We talked with Mrs. Murphy in the kitchen. A snapshot of Gary in a bathing suit was stuck up on the fridge. He looked like the all-American father.
"Gary is not a violent person. He can't even bear to discipline Ronnie,"
Missy Murphy was saying to us.
That interested me. It fit a pattern of bell curves I'd been studying for years, reports on sociopaths and their children. Sociopaths often have difficulty disciplining their children.
"Has he told you why he has difficulty disciplining your daughter?" I asked her.
"Gary didn't have a happy childhood himself. He wants only the best for Ronnie. He knows that he's compensating. He's a very bright man. He could easily have his PhD in math."
"Did Gary grow up right here in Wilmington?" Samson asked Missy.
"No, he grew up in Princeton, New Jersey. Gary lived there until he was 19.
Samson jotted a note, then he glanced my way. Princeton was near Hopewell, where the Lindbergh kidnapping had taken place in the 1930s. The son of Lindbergh, Sinigi had signed the ransom notes. We still didn't know why.
"His family is still in Princeton?" I asked Mrs. Murphy. "Can we contact them there?"
"There's no family left now. There was a fire while Gary was at school. Gary's stepmom and dad, his stepbrother and stepsister, all died in the tragedy."
I wanted to probe deeply into everything Missy Murphy was saying. I resisted for the moment.
"A fire in the house of a disturbed young man, though? Another family dead. Another family destroyed. Was that Gary Sinigi / Murphy's real target? Families?"
"Did you know any of the family?" I asked Missy.
"No. They died before Gary and I got together. The two of us met our senior year in college. I was at Delaware."
"What did your husband tell you about his years around Princeton?"
"Not very much. He keeps a lot inside. The Murphys lived several miles from town, I know. Their closest neighbor was 2 or 3 miles. Gary didn't have friends until he went to school. Even then, he was often the odd man out. He can be very shy."
"What about the brother and sister you mentioned?" Samson asked.
"Actually, they were his stepbrother and stepsister. That was part of Gary's problem. He wasn't close to them."
"Did he ever mention the Lindbergh kidnapping? Does he have any books on Lindbergh?" Samson continued.
Missy Murphy shook her head back and forth.
"No, not that I know of. There's a room filled with his books down in the cellar. You can look."
"Is his real mother alive?" I asked her.
"I don't know. Gary just won't talk about her. He won't discuss her at all."
"What about his stepmother?"
"Gary didn't like his stepmother. He called her the whore of Babylon."
After months without any information, I couldn't get the questions out fast enough. Everything I'd heard so far was tracking. An important question loomed. Had Gary Sinigi / Murphy been telling the truth to his wife?
Was he capable of telling the truth to another person?
Mrs. Murphy, do you have any idea where he might have gone? I asked now.
Something really frightened Gary, she said. I think maybe it relates to his job somehow, and to my brother, who's his employer. I can't imagine that he went back home to New Jersey, but maybe he did. Maybe Gary went back home. He is impulsive.
One of the FBI agents, Marcus Connor, peeked into the kitchen where we were talking. Can I see both of you for a minute? I'm sorry, this will just be 1 minute, he said to Mrs. Murphy. Connor escorted us down into the basement of the house. Jerry Scorse, Riley, and Kyle Craig from the FBI were already down there waiting. Scorse held up a pair of Fido Dido socklets. I recognized them from the descriptions of what Maggie Rose Dunn had been wearing the day of the kidnapping. So, what do you think, Alex? Scorse asked me. Exactly what I said about the sneaker in Washington. He left it for us, I said. The old DuPont Hotel in downtown Wilmington was a convenient place to get some sleep. It had a nice quiet bar, and Samson and I planned on doing some quiet drinking there. We didn't think we'd have company, but we were surprised when Jesse Flanagan, Kleppner, and some of the FBI agents joined us for nightcaps. We were tired and frustrated after the near miss with Garrison E.G. / Murphy. Actually, we got along well. We got loud, played liar's poker, raised some hell in the Tony Delaware room that night. Samson talked to Jesse Flanagan for a while. He thought she was a good cop, too. The drinking finally tailed down, and we wandered off to find our rooms, which were scattered throughout the spacious DuPont. Jeb Kleppner, Jesse, and I climbed the thickly carpeted stairs to our rooms on 2 and 3. Kleppner's room was on the second floor. I'm going to go watch some softcore pornography, he said as he split off from us. That usually helps me get right to sleep. Sweet dreams, Jesse said. Lobby at 7. Kleppner groaned as he trudged down the hallway to his room. Jesse and I climbed the winding flight to the next floor. I'm still wound tight, I said to her. I can see Sanigi / Murphy. Two faces. They're both very distinct in my head. I'm wired, too. It's my nature. What would you do if you were home instead of here? Jesse asked. I'd probably go play the piano out on our porch. Jesse laughed out loud. We could go back down to the Delaware room. There was an old upright in there. Probably belonged to one of the DuPonts. You play, I'll have one more drink. That bartender left about 10 seconds after we did. He's home in his bed already. We'd reached the DuPont's third floor. There was a gentle bend in the hallway. Ornate signs on the wall listed room numbers in their direction. I'm 311. Jesse pulled a white card key from the pocket of her jacket. I'm in 334, I said. Jesse smiled and she looked into my eyes. For the first time that I could remember, neither of us had anything to say. I took her into my arms and held her gently. We kissed in the hallway. I hadn't kissed anyone like that in a while. I wasn't sure who had started the kiss, actually. There's a lot of myth about black men desiring white women, about some white women wanting to experiment with black men. Jesse Flanagan was a smart, extremely desirable woman. She was somebody I could talk to, somebody I wanted to be around. And there we were, snuggled in each other's arms at around 3 in the morning. We both had a little too much to drink, but not a lot too much. No myths involved, just 2 people alone, in a strange town, on a very strange night in both of our lives. Well, Alex, Jesse said, and she raised an eyebrow. This is a knotty problem, isn't it?
Not for 2 smart cops like us, I said to her.
We took the soft left turn down the hotel hallway and headed toward room 311.
At 1:30 in the morning, Gary Sanigi / Murphy walked out of a Motel 6 in Reston, Virginia. He caught his reflection in a glass door. The new Gary looked back at him, black pompadour and a grungy beard, dusty shit-kicker's clothes. He knew he could play this part, put on an old Dixie drawl. Gary got into the battered VW and started to drive. Darkness slowly changed to a soft gray velvet. He fought the urge to step on the gas and keep it floored. An orangish tinge of morning finally arrived as he drove through Johnstown, Pennsylvania. As Sanigi/Murphy drove along Route 22 for hours, he let himself get angrier than he had been in a long time. No one was paying attention to him, not the attention he deserved. Gary Sanigi/Murphy pulled into a McDonald's in Wilkinsburg, Pennsylvania. Children of all ages loved McDonald's, right? There was the usual meandering lunchtime crowd of dopes and mopes moving in and out of Mickey D's. All of them were stuck in their daily ruts and daily rutting. He turned into the McDonald's dining room. 100 trillion McBurgers served and still counting. Women were there in droves, women and all of their precious children, the nest builders, the trivializers, the silly gooses with their silly floppy breasties. Gary paid for 2 black coffees and turned to walk back through the crowd. He purposely bumped into people as he walked away from the McDonald's counter. "Well, excuse me," he said after a jarring hip check. "Hey, watch it. Come on, mister," somebody said to him. "Watch it yourself, you jerk-off." He downed both hot coffees as he continued on through the restaurant. Then Gary Sanigi/Murphy pulled a snub-nosed revolver from under his windbreaker. This was it, the beginning of America's wake-up call, a special performance for all the kiddies and mommies. They were all watching him now. Guns, they understood. "Wake the fuck up!" he shouted inside the McDonald's dining room. "Hot coffee! Coming through, y'all! Wake up and smell it!" Gary faced the room with the revolver drawn. "No one leaves this room!" he bellowed. Gary fired a round into the face of a burger-chomping patron. The man clutched his forehead and wheeled heavily off his chair onto the floor. Now that got everybody's attention. "I am Gary Sinise. I am himself. Is that a mind-blower or what? You're in the presence of the world-famous kidnapper." He watched the fast food fans quiver. "This," he finally said in a thoughtful manner, "is what they call a dangerous hostage situation. Ronald McDonald's been kidnapped, folks. You're now officially part of history."
None of us had more than a couple of hours of sleep, some less than that. We were groggy and out of it as we cruised down U.S. Highway 22. Gary Sinigi/Murphy had been sighted several times in the area south of us. He had become the boogeyman for half the people in America. Jesse Flanagan, Jeb Kleppner, Samson and I traveled in a blue Lincoln sedan. Samson tried to sleep. We were passing through Marysville, Pennsylvania, when an emergency call came over the radio at 10 past noon. "All units, we have a shooting," the dispatcher said with a flurry of radio static. "A man claiming to be Gary Sinigi has shot at least one person inside a McDonald's in Wilkinsburg. He has at least 60 hostages trapped inside the restaurant at this time." Less than 30 minutes later, we arrived at the scene in Wilkinsburg, Pennsylvania. Samson shook his head in disgust and amazement. "Does this asshole know how to throw a party or what? Is he trying to kill himself? Is this suicide time?" Jesse Flanagan wanted to know. "I'm not surprised by anything he does, but McDonald's fits. Look at all the children. It's like the school, like Disney World," I said to them. Across the street from the restaurant, on the roof of a Kmart, I could see police or army snipers. They had high-powered rifles aimed in the direction of the golden arches on the front window. "It seems just like the McDonald's massacre a few years back, the one in Southern California," I said to Samson and Jesse. We started to hurry toward the McDonald's. We were being filmed. Television vans were double-parked everywhere. Affiliates from all 3 networks. They were shooting film of everything that moved or talked. An FBI section chief came running up to us. It was Kyle Craig, who'd been at the Murphy House in Wilmington. "We don't know if it's him for sure," he said. "This guy's dressed like a farmer. Dark hair, beard, claims to be Sinigi, but it could be some other nut." "Let me get a look," I said to Craig. "He asked for me down in Florida. He knows I'm a psychologist. Maybe I can talk to him now." Before Craig could answer, I had moved past him toward the restaurant.
I inched my way up beside a trooper and a couple of local cops, crouched near the side entrance. I flashed my badge case at them, said I was from Washington. No sound was coming from inside the McDonald's. I had to talk him back to Earth. No suicide, no big flame out at Mickey D's.
Is he making any sense? I asked the trooper. Is he coherent?
He's talking about being the kidnapper from D.C. He's bragging about it. He says he wants to be somebody important.
The gunman had control of the 60 or more people inside the McDonald's. It was silent in there.
Suniji, I called out. Are you Gary Suniji?
Who the hell are you?
A shout came right back from inside.
Who wants to know?
I'm Detective Alex Cross from Washington. I have a feeling you know all about the latest hostage rescue decision. We won't negotiate with you, so you know what happens from here on.
I know all the rules, Detective Cross. It's all public information, isn't it? The rules don't always apply.
Gary Sinise shouted back.
Not to me, they don't. Never have.
They do here, I said firmly. You can bet your life on it.
Are you willing to bet all these lives, Detective? I know another rule. Women and children go first. You follow me? Women and children have a special place with me.
I needed Suniji to understand that under no circumstances was he getting away. There would be no negotiations. If he started shooting again, we would take him down.
I don't want anyone else hurt. I don't want you hurt, I told him in a clear, strong voice.
That's very touching. I am moved by what you just said. My heart just skipped a beat, really.
You know what I mean, Gary, I softened my voice.
Certainly I do, Alex.
There are a lot of people out here with guns. No one can control them if this escalates. I can't. Even you can't. There could be an accident. That we don't want.
It was silent inside again. The thought pounding in my head was that if Suniji was suicidal, he'd end it here. We'd never know what had set him off. We would never know what had happened to Maggie Rose Dunn.
Hello, Detective Cross.
Suddenly, he was in the doorway about 5 feet away from me. He was right there. A gunshot rang from one of the rooftops. Suniji spun and grabbed his shoulder. He had been hit by one of the snipers. I leaped forward and grabbed Suniji in both arms. My right shoulder crunched into his chest. Lawrence Taylor never made a surer tackle. We fell hard to the concrete. I didn't want anyone shooting him dead now. I had to talk to him. We had to find out about Maggie Rose. As I held him on the ground, he twisted around and stared into my face. Blood from his shoulder was smeared over both of us.
Thank you for saving my life. Someday, I'll kill you for it, Detective Cross.
My name is Bobby, she had been taught to say. Always her new name, never the old one, never, ever Maggie Rose. She was locked inside a dark van or a covered truck. She wasn't sure which. She had no idea where she was now. How far or how close to her home. She didn't know how long it had been since she'd been taken away from her school. Her thinking was clearer now, almost back to normal. Someone had brought her clothes, which had to mean she wasn't going to be hurt right away. Otherwise, why would they bother with the clothes? The van or truck was filthy dirty. It had no rug or covering on the floor. It smelled like onions. Food must have been kept there. Where did they grow onions? Maggie Rose tried to remember New Jersey and upstate New York. She thought there was also the smell of potatoes, maybe turnips or sweet potatoes. When she put it all together, when she focused her mind, Maggie Rose thought she was probably being held somewhere down south. What else did she know? What else could she figure out? She wasn't being drugged anymore, not since the beginning. They seldom talked to her. When she was spoken to, they called her Bobby. Why Bobby? She was being so good about everything, but sometimes she needed to cry, like now. She was choking on her own sobs, not wanting anybody to hear her. There was only one thing that gave her strength. It was so simple, but it was powerful. She was alive. She wanted to stay alive more than anything. Maggie Rose hadn't noticed that the truck was slowing down. It was bumpy going for a while, then the vehicle came to a full stop. She heard someone getting out of the cab up front. Muffled words were spoken. She'd been told not to talk in the truck, or she'd be gagged again. Someone pushed open the sliding door. Sunlight burst in on her. She couldn't see anything at first. When she finally could make something out, Maggie Rose couldn't believe her eyes.
"Hello,"
she said in the softest whisper, almost as if she had no voice.
"My name is Bobby."
Garrison Eegee/Murphy was remanded to Lorton Federal Prison in the northern part of Virginia. We began hearing rumors that something had happened to him there, but no one from the Washington Police Department was allowed to see him. Justice and the FBI had him, and they weren't letting go of their prize. A week and a half after the capture, I went in to see Sinigi/Murphy. I had to call in every chip I had in Washington, but I got in to see him. Dr. Marion Campbell, the warden at Lorton, met me at a row of gunmetal elevators on the prison's sixth floor, the hospital floor. Campbell was in his 60s. He was well-preserved with a flowing mane of black hair. "You're Detective Cross." He extended his hand and smiled politely. "Yes." "I'm also a forensic psychologist," I explained. Dr. Campbell seemed genuinely surprised by that information. Evidently no one had told him.
"Well, you certainly have some pull to get in to talk with him. It's gotten rather complicated. Visiting rights with him are a precious commodity."
"I've been involved with this since he took the two kids in Washington. I was there when he was caught."
"Well, I'm not sure if we're talking about the same man now," Dr. Campbell said. He didn't explain. "Is it Dr. Cross?" he asked.
"Dr. Cross, Detective Cross, Alex, you pick.
Please come with me, Doctor. You're going to find this most interesting."
Because of the gunshot wound Sinigi got at McDonald's, he was being kept in a private room in the prison hospital. Dr. Campbell led me down a wide corridor inside the hospital.
"I'm afraid I've become a little protective of him," Campbell said as we walked. "You'll see why in a moment. Everybody wants to see him. I've received calls from all over the world. An author from Japan had to see him. A doctor from Frankfurt, another from London, that sort of thing."
"I get the feeling there's something you're not telling me about him, Doctor. What is it?"
"I want you to draw your own conclusions, Dr. Cross. He's right here in this section near the main ward. I would very much like your opinion."
We stopped at a bolted steel door in the hospital corridor. A guard let us through. Beyond the door were a few more hospital rooms, but rooms for maximum security. A light burned brightly inside the first room. It wasn't Sinigi's. He was in a darker room on the left. The regular prison visiting area had been ruled out because it offered too much exposure. Two guards with shotguns sat outside the room. "Has there been any violence?" I asked.
"No, not at all. I'll leave you two to talk. I don't think you'll have to be concerned about any violence. You'll see for yourself."
Garrison Eegee/Murphy watched us from his cot. His arm was in a sling. Otherwise, he looked the same as the last time I'd seen him. I stood inside the hospital room. When Dr. Campbell walked away, Sinigi studied me. There was no sign of recognition from this man who'd threatened to kill me when we'd last met. My first professional impression was that he seemed afraid to be left alone with me. His body language was tentative, very different from the man I'd wrestled to the ground at the McDonald's in Wilkinsburg.
"Who are you? What do you want with me?"
he finally said. "I'm Alex Cross. We've met." He looked confused. The expression on his face was very believable, too. He shook his head and closed his eyes.
"I'm sorry. I don't remember you."
It seemed an apology.
"There have been so many people in this nightmare, I forget some of you. Hello, please, pull up a chair."
"You asked for me during the negotiations in Florida. I'm with the Washington police." As soon as I said that, he started to smile. He looked off to the side and shook his head. I wasn't in on the joke yet. I told him I wasn't.
"I've never been to Florida in my life. Not once."
Garrison Eegee/Murphy stood up from his cot. He was wearing loose-fitting hospital whites. His arm seemed to be giving him some pain. He looked lonely and vulnerable. Something was very wrong here. What in hell was going on? Shinichi/Murphy sat down in the other chair. He stared at me with a baleful look. He didn't look like a killer. He didn't look like a kidnapper.
I've never spoken to you in my life. I've never heard of Alex Cross. I didn't kidnap any children. Do you know Kafka?
Some. What's your point?
I feel like Gregor Samson, Metamorphosis. I'm trapped in a nightmare. None of this makes any sense to me. I didn't kidnap anyone's children. Someone has to believe me. Someone has to. I'm Gary Murphy, and I never harmed anyone in my entire life.
If I followed him, what he was telling me was that he was a multiple personality. Truly, Gary Shinichi/Murphy.
But do you believe him, Alex?
Scores Craig and Riley from the Bureau, Kleppner and Jesse Flanagan from the Secret Service, and Samson and I were in a cramped conference room at FBI headquarters downtown. The question had come from Jerry Scores. Not surprisingly, he didn't believe Shinichi/Murphy. He didn't buy the multiple personality bit. What does he really gain from telling a lot of outrageous lies? I asked everyone to consider. He says he didn't kidnap the children. He says he didn't shoot anyone at the McDonald's. He claims to be this pleasant enough nobody from Delaware named Gary Murphy. Temp insanity plea, Riley offered the obvious. He goes to some cushy asylum in Maryland or Virginia, out in 7 to 10 years maybe. You can bet he knows that, Alex. Is he clever enough? A good enough actor to pull it off? So far, I've spoken to him only once, less than an hour with him. I'll say this, he's very convincing as Gary Murphy. I think he's legitimately VFC.
What the hell is VFC?
Scores asked. It's a common enough psych term, I told him. All of us shrinks talk about VFC when we get together.
Very fucking crazy.
Everybody around the table laughed except Scores.
Very fucking funny, Alex, Scores finally said. That's VFF.
Can you get in to see him again? Jesse asked me.
Yeah, I can. He wants to see me. Maybe I'll even find out why in the hell he asked for me down in Florida. Why I'm the chosen one in his nightmare.
2 days later, I wangled another hour with Gary Shinichi/Murphy. I've been up the previous 2 nights rereading multiple personality cases. My dining room looked like a carol at a psych library. Gary was sitting on his hospital cot, staring into space when I arrived. His shoulder sling was gone.
Hello, Gary, I said softly. Are you ready to talk?
He turned around and seemed glad to see me. He pulled a chair over for me by his cot.
I was afraid they wouldn't let you come. I'm glad they did.
What made you think they wouldn't let me come? I wanted to know.
Oh, I don't know. I felt you were someone I might be able to talk to. The way my luck's been going, I thought they would shut you right off.
There was a naivete about him that was troubling to me. What were you just thinking about? A minute ago, I asked, before I interrupted. He smiled and shook his head.
I don't even know. What was I thinking about? Oh, I know what it was. I was remembering it's my birthday this month. I keep thinking I'm suddenly going to wake up out of this.
Go back a little for me. Tell me how you were arrested again, I said, changing the subject.
I woke up. I came to in a police car outside of McDonald's.
He was consistent on that point. He told me the same thing 2 days before.
My arms were handcuffed behind my back. Later on, they used leg irons, too.
You don't know how you got into the police car?
No. And I don't know how I got to a McDonald's in Wilkinsburg, either.
Has anything like this ever happened to you before? Anything vaguely like it, Gary?
No, I've never been in any trouble, never been arrested. You can check that.
I mean, have you ever woken up in a strange place before? No idea how you got there. Gary gave me a strange look. His head cocked slightly.
Why would you ask that?
Did you, Gary?
Well, yes.
Tell me about it. Tell me about those times when you woke up in a strange place.
For the past year or so, maybe more than that, I've suffered from insomnia. I told that to one of the doctors who came to see me.
There was nothing about insomnia in any of the prison workups. I wondered if he told any of the doctors or simply imagined that he had. There was stuff about an uneven Wechsler profile, indicative of impulsivity. There was a verbal IQ and a performance IQ, both through the roof. There was a Rorschach profile that reflected severe emotional stress. There was a positive response to TAT, card number 14, the so-called suicide card, but not a word about insomnia.
Tell me about it, please. It could help me to understand.
He looked into my eyes.
Will you really try to help me? Not trap me, doctor. Help me.
I told him that I'd try. I listened to what he had to say.
I haven't been able to sleep for a while. This goes back for as long as I can remember. It was becoming a jumble, being awake, dreams. I had trouble sorting one out from the other. I woke up in that police car in Pennsylvania. I have no idea how I got there. That's really how it happened. Do you believe me? Somebody has to believe me.
I'm listening to you, Gary. When you've finished, I'll tell you what I think, I promise. For the moment, I have to hear everything you remember.
You asked if it's happened to me before? It has, a few times. Waking in strange places. Sometimes in my car, pulled over along some road. Sometimes a road I've never seen or even heard of. A couple of times it happened in motels. Or wandering the streets, Philadelphia, New York, Atlantic City one time. I had casino chips and a complimentary parking ticket in my pocket. No idea how they got there.
Did it ever happen to you in Washington?
No, not in Washington. I haven't been in Washington since I was a kid, actually. Lately, I found I can come to in a conscious state, completely conscious. I might be eating a meal, for example, but I have no idea how I got in the restaurant.
Did you see anybody about this? Did you try to get help? A doctor?
We don't have money to spend on psychiatrists. We're barely scraping by. That's why I've been so depressed. We're in the hole over 30 grand. My family is 30,000 in debt, and I'm here in prison.
So far, I believe you. What you're saying makes sense to me, Gary. I'd like to help you if I can. Tears suddenly welled in his eyes and rolled down his cheeks. He put his hands out to me. I reached out and I held Gary Sinigi / Murphy's hands. They were very cold. He seemed to be afraid.
I'm innocent. I know it sounds crazy, but I'm innocent.
The next day I drove out to Lorton Prison. That was when a bright idea hit me. A testable theory about Gary Sinigi / Murphy that seemed to make some sense in psych terms. Having an interesting theory du jour helped my concentration at the prison. I was taken up to the 6th floor to see Sinigi. He was waiting for me. He looked as if he hadn't slept all night. I went at him for a full hour that afternoon, maybe even a little longer. I pushed hard. Gary, have you ever found receipts in your pockets? Hotels, restaurants, store purchases, but you have no memory of spending the money?
How did you know that?
His eyes lit up at my question.
I told them I wanted you to be my doctor. I don't want to see Dr. Walsh anymore. All he's good for is script for chloral hydrate.
I'm not sure that's a good idea. I'm a psychologist, not a psychiatrist like Dr. Walsh. I'm also part of the team that helped arrest you. He shook his head.
I know all that. You're also the only one who's listened before making final judgments. I know you hate me. The idea that I took those two children, the other things I'm supposed to have done, but you listen, at least. Walsh only pretends to listen.
You need to continue seeing Dr. Walsh.
That's fine. I guess I understand the politics here by now. Just please, don't leave me in this hellhole by myself.
I won't. I'm with you all the way from here on. We'll continue to talk just like this. I asked Sinigi / Murphy to tell me about his childhood.
I don't remember a whole lot about growing up. Is that very strange?
He wanted to talk. It was in my hands, my judgment, to determine whether I was hearing the truth or a set of elaborately constructed lies. That's normal for some people, not remembering. Sometimes things come back when you talk about them, when you verbalize.
I know the facts and statistics. Okay, birth date, February 24th, 1957, birthplace, Princeton, New Jersey, things like that. Sometimes I feel like I learned all that while I was growing up, though. I've had experiences where I can't separate dreams from reality. I'm not sure which is which. I'm really not sure.
Try to give me your first impressions, I told him.
Not a lot of fun and laughs. I've always had insomnia. I could never sleep more than an hour or two at a time. I can't remember not being tired, and
depressed, like I've been trying to dig myself out of a hole my entire life.
Gary went on to sketch a terrifying childhood, which included physical abuse from his stepmother as a small child, sexual abuse from his father as he got older. Over and over, he described how he was forced to split himself off from the anxiety and conflict that surrounded him. His stepmother had come with her two children in 1961. Gary was 4 years old and already moody. It got worse from that point on. As part of his workup under Dr. Walsh, Suniji/Murphy had taken Wechsler Adult, Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, and Rorschach tests. Where he sailed completely off the scales was in the area of creativity. This was measured by single-sentence completion. He scored equally high in both verbal and written responses. What else, Gary? Try to go as far back as you can.
There were always these lost hours, time I couldn't account for. They punished me because I couldn't remember.
Who did? Who punished you?
My stepmother, mostly.
That probably meant most of the damage had happened when he was very young, while his stepmother did the disciplining.
A dark room.
What happened in the dark room? What kind of room was it?
She put me in there, down in the basement. It was our cellar, and she put me down there almost every day.
He was beginning to hyperventilate. This was extremely difficult for him, a condition I'd seen many times with child abuse victims. He shut his eyes, remembering, seeing a past he never really wanted to encounter again. What would happen down in the basement?
Nothing. Nothing happened. I was just punished all the time, left by myself.
How long were you kept down there?
I don't know. I can't remember everything.
His eyes opened halfway. He watched me through narrow slits. I wasn't sure how much more he could take. I had to be careful. I needed to ease him into the tougher parts of his history with the feeling that I cared, that he could trust me, that I was listening. Was it for a whole day sometimes? Overnight?
Oh, no. No, it was for a long, long time. So I wouldn't forget anymore. So I'd be a good boy, not the bad boy.
He looked at me, but said nothing more. That was good, Gary. A good start. I know how hard this is for you. As I looked at the grown man, I imagined a small boy kept in a darkened cellar. Every day. For weeks that must have seemed even longer than that. Then I thought about Maggie Rose Dunn. Was it possible that he was keeping her somewhere and that she was still alive? I needed to get the darkest secrets out of his head and needed to do it faster than it's ever done in therapy. This was a very risky time in our session. He could become frightened and refuse to see me again if he sensed that I was no longer a friend. I needed to keep praising Gary for his efforts. It was important that he look forward to my visits. What you've told me so far should be extremely helpful, I said to him. You really did a great job. I'm impressed by how much you forced yourself to remember. As I started to leave, he said,
Alex, honest to God, I didn't do anything horrible or bad. Please help me.
A polygraph test had been scheduled for him that afternoon. Just the thought of the lie detector made Gary nervous, but he swore he was glad to take it. He told me I could stay and wait for the results if I wanted to. I wanted to very much. The polygraph operator was a particularly good one who had been brought from D.C. for the testing. 18 questions were to be asked. 15 of those were controls. The other 3 were to be used for scoring the lie detector test. Dr. Campbell met with me about 40 minutes after Suniji/Murphy had been taken down for his polygraph. Campbell was flushed with excitement. Something big had happened.
He got the highest score possible, Campbell told me. He passed with flying colors, plus 10s. Gary Murphy could be telling the truth.
I held a command performance in the boardroom inside Lorton Prison the following afternoon. The important audience included Dr. Campbell from the prison, Federal District Attorney James Dowd, a representative from the Governor of Maryland's office, 2 more attorneys from the Attorney General's office in Washington, and Dr. James Walsh from the state's health board, as well as the prison's advisory staff. It had been an ordeal to get them together. Now that I had succeeded, I couldn't lose them. I wouldn't get another chance to ask for what I needed. I want to try regressive hypnosis on him.
There's no risk, but there's a chance for high reward, I announced to the group. I'm certain Suniji/Murphy will be a good subject, that we'll find out something we can use. Maybe we'll learn what happened to the missing girl. Certainly something about Gary Murphy. Several complex jurisdictional questions had already been raised by the case. One lawyer had told me the issues would make for an excellent bar exam question. Since state lines had been crossed, the kidnapping and murder of Michael Goldberg had fallen under federal jurisdiction and would be tried in federal court. The killings in McDonald's would be tried in a Westmoreland court. Suniji/Murphy could also be tried in Washington for one or more of the killings he had apparently committed in Southeast. What would you ultimately hope to accomplish? Dr. Campbell wanted to know. He'd been supportive and was continuing to be so. Like me, he read skepticism on several faces, especially Walsh's. A lot of what he's told us so far suggests a severe dissociative reaction. He appears to have suffered a pretty horrible childhood. There was physical abuse, maybe sexual abuse as well. He may have begun to split off his psyche to avoid pain and fear back then. I'm not saying that he's a multiple, but it's a possibility. He had the kind of childhood that could produce such a rare psychosis. Dr. Campbell picked up. Dr. Cross and I have talked about the possibility that Suniji/Murphy undergoes fugue states, psychotic episodes that relate to both amnesia and hysteria. He talks about lost days, lost weekends, even lost weeks. In such a fugue state, a patient can wake in a strange place and have no idea how he got there or what he had been doing for a prolonged period. In some cases, the patients have two separate personalities, often antithetical personalities. This can also happen in temporal lobe epilepsy. What are you guys, a tag team? Walsh grunted from his seat. Lobe epilepsy. Give me a break, Marion. The more you fool around like this, the better his chance of getting off in a courtroom, Walsh warned. I'm not fooling around, I said to Walsh. Not my style. The DA spoke up, intervening between Walsh and me. James Dowd was a serious man in his late 30s or early 40s. If Dowd got to try the case of Suniji/Murphy, he would soon be an extremely famous attorney. Isn't there a possibility that he's created this apparently psychotic condition for our benefit? Dowd asked. That he's a psychopath and nothing more than that? That's a definite possibility, I said. It's one of the reasons I'd like to try the regressive hypnosis. For one thing, we can see if his stories remain consistent. If he's susceptible to hypnosis, Walsh interjected, and if you can tell whether or not he'd been hypnotized. I suspect that he is susceptible, I answered quickly. And I have my doubts that he is. Frankly, I have my doubts about you, Cross. I don't care that he likes to talk to you. Psychiatry isn't about liking your doctor. What he likes is that I listen, I glared across the table at Walsh. What are the other reasons for hypnotizing the prisoner? The governor's representative spoke up. Frankly, we don't know enough about what he's done during these fugue states, Dr. Campbell said. Neither does he. Neither do his wife and family, whom I've interviewed several times now. I added, we're also not sure how many personalities might be operating. The other reason for hypnosis is that I do want to ask him about Maggie Rose Dunn. I want to try to find out what he did with Maggie Rose. Well, we've heard your arguments, Dr. Cross. Thank you for your time and efforts here, James Dowd said at the end of the presentation. We'll have to let you know. I decided to take things into my own hands that evening. I called a reporter I knew and trusted at the Post. I asked him to meet me at Pappy's Diner on the edge of Southeast. Lee Cavell was a graying yuppie and kind of an asshole, but I liked him. Lee wore his emotions on his sleeve, his petty jealousies, his bitterness about the sad state of journalism, his bleeding heart tendencies, his occasional arch-conservative traits. It was all out there for the world to see and react to. Lee plopped down next to me at the counter. He was wearing a gray suit and light blue running shoes. Alex, what's on your mind? Why didn't you call me when this story was hot, before this sucker got caught? Would you give this man some hot, very black coffee? I said to the counterman. I need to wake him up. I turned back to Lee. I'm going to hypnotize Suniji inside the prison. I'm going looking for Maggie Rose Dunn in his subconscious. You can have the exclusive. But you owe me one, I told Lee. Lee Cavell almost spit out his reaction. Bullshit. Let's hear it all, Alex. I think you left out some parts. Right. I'm working to get permission to hypnotize Suniji.
there are a lot of petty politics involved. If you leak the story in the Post, I think it will happen. The theory of self-fulfilling prophecies. I'll get permission, then you get an exclusive. The coffee came in a beautiful old diner cup. Lee slurped the java, thoughtful as hell.
And if you do hear something from Gary Sinise, I'll be the second to know, after yourself, Alex.
You drive a hard bargain, but yeah, that'll be our deal. Think about it, Lee. It's for a worthy cause. Finding out about Maggie Rose, not to me.